they all have this discontinuity naturalness, Brian. They either they have, like, do, you know, Primitive Zappa. They'll bring in some weird sounds and then this, and they flip the moods. It's very quadraphenic naturally, these young composers.
For sure, and, like, it's all about this, I don't know, it's all about a certain quality of sort of just you the way that you always move on quickly from any, regardless of, you know, how awesome a point you just made or something.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it just keeps going by fast, and, you know, the beat relentlessly carries you on, sort of a deal.
Yeah, they don't have a point of view. They just have four stomachs they're trying to process their chip body stomach, all that they consume, the TV body stomach, the astral stomach, and the chemical body stomach. And they're just, like, even when they're singing and recording, they hardly have time to do the recording. They must keep monitoring whatever the vibrates are doing to their stomachs.
It's just all about that. I find it interesting that 4-4 beats, that fundamentally four-based beats, really became the only thing anyone wanted to hear in pop music or something. Like, there isn't some waltz subgenre.
Right.
All the beats are four beats. And, like, when I was very first getting into your stuff in the 2002 kind of time, part of this whole idea of the tetradic kind of come alive and us being outside of it, it seemed to very perfectly plug into a musical taste where over the last couple of decades, but especially myself in the previous few years, there'd been a big explosion of interest in just purely tetradic music with no vocals or anything or any recognizable instruments and just this rave beats of just relentless 4-4. That just tetradic inter-organization shifting became its own just fascinating thing people could spend hours and hours and hours every day listening to, and they still can. And then it becomes a little bit more focused on having the humans reappear over top of the beat and have vocal samples, and now all the club music has, all the songs have vocals. It used to be the club rave music was very non-vocal. It was only a certain kind of annoying e-pill addict that wanted to hear happy-sounding vocals over top of their beats, like...
Mm.
But now the vocals have come back into vogue as, you know, we go further into the reappearance era.
Yes, the reappearance, that's right. Let's see. I'm just scanning through. It's the media. I'm looking for on McLuhan which thread. I think this is it. Rhetoric is a moral discipline. It's the beginning, I think, of this Catholic talk.
Yes.
I found the thread. What is the picture? It's a Burroughs review, actually. That's odd that this happens in the Burroughs thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you get into this Catholicism, right?
Yeah.
And
well, that was the only thing I could find that Burroughs ever said that seemed positive or supportive of McLuhan.
He
snarked back at Brian Geisen after Geisen had said something about, oh, well, blah, blah, so-and-so's a Catholic, and blah, blah, blah. And Burroughs was like, so what if he's a Catholic? McLuhan's a Catholic. He gave one of the only thoughtful reviews of Nova Express. Like, if someone acts like a friend, then who cares?
Yeah, that's right. If he acts like a friend. So,
But never in public. Burroughs never said any nice thing about McLuhan in public. Interesting.
That's right. And you saw I tell my story when I brought up what... See, Burroughs said about 1970, some L.A. Free Press article, it was just a passing statement. It says, Marshall McLuhan is a word analyst. So I mentioned this to Marshall. He says, well, if you consider bulldozers, televisions, huge media environments as words, or as the word, as included in the meaning of the word, which he was just starting to really emphasize that in the mid-70s, late-70s, how his big discovery was all technologies are words, and he would italicize words. You know, in the sentence, italicize it. So that would mean it's both form and content. It's everything. Everything is linguistic gesture. So then I get a chance a few years later, late 70s, to meet Burroughs, and I continue to be liaison, said Cosmic Awareness back in October 1969. Liaison and interaction is what I do. And so I said, oh, even though it's 4 years later, Bill, I forgot to tell you. Last time I was at 222 Bowery, which is what his bunker was, Kelly. It was a 222 bunker.
Yeah.
I think it was on Bowery, right? Bowery or Broadway, maybe Broadway. Just down
there. Bowery, but
it's near the. It was near CBGB's, and so I said to him, I relayed that McClune said the word is the all word analysis includes all media, and he sits there in his typical stiff, not say a word self. He says nothing. Doesn't even look at me. He just sort of pretends he's pondering it, but to get more of a sense of a discomfort, or he's not interested in even thinking about the sentence.
Yeah,
kind of vibe coming from him.
Yeah, he's not. He doesn't want to. He doesn't want to emit any kind of. He doesn't seem to want to emit any kind of a positive signal about McLuhan.
That's right. That's right. I think he said. Eventually, he says. He's just up to, and we were at the Nova Scotia, we were at the Dundas and College, no, McCall, like McCall and Dundas, where the art college is, called the OCAD, Ontario College of Art and Design. He was a guest at a class, and I found out about this, so that's why I got to talk to him. He says, eventually he goes, doesn't he just live up the street? And it was true. The McClune Center was not that far away, but he knew where it was. He said, he's just up the street, right? And I said, yep.
Mm-hmm.
That's all he said. And what his main idea to the students was, at that point, I'm pretty sure, because it was an interesting idea, he says, the gay world, the gay community has to form a CIA, has to form an intelligence agency. That's what his vision was.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
I don't know if he ever said that publicly, but it was pretty interesting. He understood decentralization was happening. Yes, the gays would get their state or some part of the territory. They'd make their own independent colony or solar colony or take over Manhattan or something. But he said, if you do that, you're up against the hostile, ongoing dark ages, and you're going to have to get intelligence agency to protect yourself.
Yeah.
So he's very practical.
Yeah.
Know?
Yeah, it's true.
Okay.
I mean, him saying a word analyst would definitely be a dismissive way of. And I mean, it's just interesting because
he doesn't even get McLuhan. McLuhan's not
there
a word
to
analyst.
Be a total going over his head or something.
Right. McLuhan will accept the definition if you make words not mean what people think words mean. They include everything. I'm an analyst of everything, not just words per se. So, McLuhan corrected him, and Burroughs just didn't even give him credit for being a great science fiction writer. And just he's a word analyst. Words show up, and no, he's a fad analyst, was what McLuhan was. The passing fannies, he called it.
Right.
He's always up to date on the fads. Now, this is going to relate to his Catholicism. So, let's see.
Well, this started with you. You had posted a response that you'd made to, I think, Mark Stallman.
Oh yes, I'm on his case. Stallman is there occasionally, and he goes on and on about Marshall was at war with the world on behalf of the Catholics. Now, what a stupid, limited. Why would he be interested in McLuhan if he was just that? But
on behalf of the dead Catholics, maybe.
Yeah. And so he's saying that McLuhan was very clever, put on the pagan mythologies around him, seemed like he was part of it, hung out with Tim Leary and everybody, all the pagan guys, but he was infiltrating them, says Mark Stallman. Now, Mark gets on this kick because when I met him in March 1998, he was in the audience for my talk at the Lincoln Center, the Legacy of McLuhan conference that Lance Straight started, and it led to the creation of the Media Ecology Association. So it was a big and important McLuhan scholars, first time they ever really got together, 45 of them. And Mark came up after the lecture and said, hey, you mentioned some letter. I'd like to have that. So I said, okay, I'll meet you at the the end of the day. So we got together, and then he invited me over to his place, and I found out that he was a bodyguard for LaRouche, and that was interesting. And he was amazed I even knew about LaRouche. No intellectuals knew. We put LaRouche and McLuhan together. That shocked him. And he was just sort of learning about McLuhan. He tried to in the early 90s, and he showed me a recording of it eventually. He's not too good at it, but he was hosting Alvin Toffler and infiltrating Alvin Toffler at the time. That's about 94. So so I brought in the unpublished stuff, like the article you're quoting on the chat line today, the Melville review of Melville called "The Heart of Darkness." I don't think that was published, and I had a whole bunch.
That
of
seems
other ones.
Like that would be one of his favorite things McLuhan ever wrote. Because I remember Mark Stallman was like, "Is Bob Dobbs a Gnostic?"
He's very suspicious of using mediums. But he used right. The medium, the Evergreens, with me at first, and he liked them. He doesn't like Ion. He told me once, he came on in the early, like on Tailgate, about 2010. He had a private session, and he came on with Ion. He had a private session. He wasn't impressed. But he came on, and he said to me later, Ion wouldn't answer my question. And there was all these voices talking to Ion on the tailgate. He says, Ion took it personally, it sounded like, that Ion wouldn't single out the great Mark Stallman and answer his issues. But so Mark disappeared. But and then he started complaining about me on various forums that I had betrayed him in a way. We were good friends and all that, and all of a sudden I revealed that I wasn't a Catholic propagandist. That was something else, but you can't categorize me, so forget it. But so I showed him these articles, really good ones, all unpublished. I eventually published the Eliot and the Manichaean Myth and Poetry that I excerpt in the long essay on schools of mediocology, which I excerpted in the thread here, that long one that gets into Claudel, the poet, maybe his name's Paul Claudel, how he, the Catholic, is not involved with the Gnostic vertical symbolist secret society system, yeah. Nor the horizontal secret society system. And the horizontal is a wilderness of mirrors, and you annihilate yourself by plunging into the wilderness of mirrors. That's the Lord Byron technique. Or you rise above it all and meditate or have a moral discipline above it all. That's a Platonic, a vertical version, like that's a T.S. Eliot move. The Catholic is not concerned either way, because the Catholic is in this world but not of it. So the Catholic plays them off. So actually the Catholic is in, according to McLuhan's understanding, the Catholic poet example, Paul Claudel, I don't think his name is Paul, but Claudel, he is a perfect Catholic poet because he's in neither position, so he's in the tactile zone.
Right.
He's being tactility, which is the gap, which is McLuhan's interpretation of the cross. It represents the intersection, the gap.
Yeah, the intersection.
Yeah. And so it's really important. And then television becomes an extension of tactility, so it's a macrocosmic gesticulation of the intersection, which is interesting. So, so I'm saying about these papers, and this was the stuff Mark really wanted. He had gone to Toronto.
Just left the conference.
I gotta fix that stuff. I have to change the button. Change name to none. We won't hear that again. He had gone to Toronto to see if McLuhan had written on power, because Mark was a LaRouche. He was interested in the Marcuse side of things. There's this book I bought with. Posits McLuhan versus Marcuse. McLuhan doing the bottom up and Marcuse doing the top down. Well, LaRouche is into the top down, and so he wanted to see if McLuhan, and I don't know who he spoke to, Barry Everett, Eric, somebody, Wayne Constant, no, someone told him, oh, you want to read Take Today, The Executive's Dropout, which had come out 22 years before. So Mark is getting the book 22 years later. That means he's in my vortex before he meets me, right? And
yeah.
And so then I had this unpublished stuff, which went more into power and the secret societies. That was really what he was looking for. So he got so excited by it, that's why we formed the Nonlinear Circle, which he retrieved all his digital Silicon Alley friends. Not in New York, it was Silicon Alley, not Valley. And Carol and I and him had this very interesting involvement with the digital, the digerati of New York that Mark knew well. He knew them all. He actually coined the term Silicon Alley, apparently, back in 95 or so. But this is in July. This is May, June 98. And we started it because he met George Soros' secretary.
Wait. Sorry, just before I forget, I got to... Where's Silicon Galley? Where all
A-L-L-E-Y.
Oh, I know. I'm just imagining another version where it's Silicon Galley.
Well, it's West 20th Street. It's the streets around West 20th, which is where Mark lived. And Mark used to live at 36 West 20th. And just down the street, that's between 5th and 6th. And right down the corner of 6th, at the corner of 20th and 6th Avenue, Mark being between 5th and 6th, is the famous Limelight Disco, which was the Lindisfarne Institute that David Lawrence Rockefeller funded William Irwin Thompson to be there in the mid to late 70s with Gregory Bateson and a lot of these MK Ultra guys from Roosh's point of view hanging out with Thompson. It was in that building. Then it got taken over by a Canadian guy, Pete or somebody, and he got busted in the early 90s for dealing drugs in the Limelight. But it was in the Limelight in August 84 where I connected with Frank. Henry called me and said, "Hey, Frank's going to be there tonight." I flew down there real fast, and that's when we talked
about... That was in that building?
In that building. It was the Limelight Disco now in the 80s.
Because that's become legendary for the... Like,
murder.
The movie Party Monster about that murder, yeah.
Yes, Michael Elijah, if I got the name right, Michael Aya.
I think it's... Just Alig, I think.
Yeah,
A-L-I-G.
Not Elijah. Michael I.R. or something. Yes, and 8-Bit, who is now Geo, who, do you know who 8-Bit is? My colleague.
I remember 8-Bit from the forum. I don't know who they are in terms of connecting it
to he's a guy.
Or to a person.
And we're working with him now, and he was a kid. He was part of the first hackers, the Masters of Deception or something. And he got busted as a kid in high school, and then he was not on computers from, like, grade 10 to 12, and then he became an All-American student and an athlete. And then at the end of grade 12, when he's out of school, someone shows him he can make music on computers. He goes, holy shit. So that would be, like, the late 80s, maybe 1990. So he then got into that scene at the Limelight with Michael and all those people. So he knew all those people. And later, MIA, that woman... rapper, whatever you call her, you know, Mia,
yeah.
M.I.A.
Oh, yeah.
She came anonymously after being kicked out of the United States after fucking up the national anthem thing in the Super Bowl with Madonna or somebody. She made the power salute, so they deported her, but she smuggled herself back in, and 8-Bit didn't know her, and otherwise known as Sheehan or Geo, found her knocking on his door because he was a legend and she wanted him to make her next album. So that's his story.
Awesome.
So anyways, why am I saying him? So Geo, okay, so he was at Limelight and told me about that era. I didn't know. It's a movie? What's it called?
Party Monster.
Oh, I haven't seen that. I'll have to check that out. Party Monster. So every generation has that. I'm just reading a few months ago, there was some guy, a rich guy from the United States, who goes to Paris in the 20s, and he has a wife, I think, and they fuck everybody who moves. They're friends of James Joyce. He's probably in Finnegan's Wake. And he eventually blows up. He kills somebody or he fucks up and dies, you know, 1930 when the party's over. And that's the 20s, and you can probably find someone did that in the 50s, someone did it in the 60s. 80s. Every generation has some monster guy that's like living the good life, not working, having fun, drugging, sexing, rock and roll, jazzing, jizzing, and then blows up, you know, and then that kind of ends the end of the era. We got many of them in 1970. You got Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, and probably a couple other guys. They all went up at the same time. With Frank sitting there, interviewed on CBC, Frank Zappa is, I wish you remember this, we would have seen this at 242 Wimmo Road. He's there smoking smoke rings coming out as the CBC guy asks him, do you remember that, Cal? The smoke rings? And he's calmly there and he's being asked by the CBC journalist to assess the meaning of these deaths. And he had no dramatic interpretation. He didn't say they're murdered. He said, well, basically that's their choice. Something like that, like very detached, and making smoke rings as they spiraled out. Now, there's an interview that should be good to see in an archive.
Wow. Every death is a suicide.
Yeah, every death is a suicide. He was ionic
already. Their choice.
Yeah. like, I said, okay, great, no problem. No, he was very blasé about it. And, okay, so, geez, see how Bob goes all over the place? I am the middle, I am the mental version, the conversational version of this Michael murderer. metaphysical promiscuity. So,
right, well, it's the Mark Stallman backstory to build up to you explaining to him why he's doing such a disservice to McLuhan.
That's right. I love to do that. So he loved this stuff, and so we would go on the Mediacology list, and another one, the Technorealist, with Douglas Rushkoff and some of these other guys that became famous of that generation in the 2000s. Like Stephen Johnson, I think, is one of them. They became writers for Wired, of the later Wired after it was sold. And Mark and I would go in there and talk about I would see Mark on his job. He used to be on Wall Street. And he would go into work early, look at what technologies are happening, investigate them, figure out the stocks, and then he would tell the brokers when they came in, you know, an hour later, what to buy or sell or push. So he was used to writing these short memos in the beginning of the morning before people came to work. So he's really had his habit of writing memos. So every day he would take the conversation we had the night before, and he'd write a memo to the MEA, just blast them all with this mixture of LaRoucheisms, CIA runs Mediacology, and McLuhan was a Catholic, and his secret battle was to preserve Catholicism, and all the rest was a fake put on. And all you guys got screwed by television, the pagan idolatry. Okay, so Mark eventually didn't like how I was not supporting him or being as blatantly on his side, and he got mad at me, and eventually I had to ban him from my Facebook page because he came in with all the old arguments, all the same old crap. I'm a Gnostic, cosmic awareness is Gnosticism, evergreens are Gnostic, and we believe this, believe that. So we don't need that echo. And meanwhile, I am moves forward, and he missed it. Ion is the most amazing thing in human history. Even you, Brian, probably don't realize that, but we do because we have the inside involvement with Ion. So that colors my view of McLuhan, especially when McLuhan, according to Ion, is a parallel worlder, had three families. I assume that's in different worlds, but they're all pretty close, these worlds. And you can hear McLuhan talk on McLuhan and Maui. Have you listened to much of that?
Unfortunately, no, not really.
Oh, you got to listen.
I've read a bunch of the blog post things, or I've seen a bunch of McLuhan on Maui links, but I've only listened to, like, a couple of them. I know there was somehow that whole centenary, it was one of these situations where it was the same thing with the initial Ion stuff in 2009, that I knew I was missing something great, but it just seemed like I just didn't have the attention for it, or I'd come back to it later or something. It seemed like the right thing to do somehow, but I
right,
know
and
that's
also,
fantastic stuff I need to listen to.
Yeah, weren't you digitally handicapped at that point?
Yes, there was that too.
Yeah, it was too hard. You had to go to libraries and stuff to have a computer. So, and we were doing, you know, it's 5-hour shows with Ion, and now many of them, you go to the later ones, McLuhan is speaking through Ion, and we're talking to McLuhan, and we're getting into all this religious stuff, and McLuhan is talking about the symbolism. It's really amazing stuff. And then Corinne comes in, his wife, and she's very articulate, and she's important. So we actually have some simulation of McLuhan, and when you know McLuhan like I do, you know that the McLuhan is saying the right thing. For example, Ion said that what was really important for McLuhan was the symbolism between the moon and the sun. And that is right there in 1953 in the James Joyce articles. That's something that no one talks about, but I noticed years ago and have thought about it. And here's Ion nailing it, or having McLuhan say it. Sometimes it's Ion saying what McLuhan's saying. Other times it's just blatantly McLuhan talking, you know, so it goes back and forth. But that was a clincher there, to know that, to say that. And you can look in Cultures Are Business. There's an ad of these witches looking at the moon, and it's about in the future you'll be able to, the moon will be a suburb of the planet, and everybody just take the little local rocket there, and he says something about that, and there's the symbolism of the night people and the moon, and what does he say, for the ad, and then it has all his commentary on the ad, but the quote is, quoting some kid said, "If it wasn't for Edison, we'd be watching TV by candlelight."
Right, right.
If it wasn't for Edison, we'd be watching TV by candlelight. So that's in there. I'm pretty sure that's the one. So this moon-sun thing. Now, McLuhan used to say about his rival that Northrop Frye was the sun of literary criticism, the S-U-N, the bright light of bullshit, you know. And so McLuhan's even ambivalent about which side he's on. So he puts down Northrop Frye for being the sun, and McLuhan, in one of his copies of Finnegan's Wake, where he annotates the page 254, which is about him, it's Marshall McMuhan. M-U-H-U-N, McMuhan. And he writes to the side, Moonchild, which is, yeah, astrologically, I think that's what a Cancer was or something. He's a Cancer, July 21st. And so he had all that symbolism right there, McLuhan, Moonchild. Now, is McLuhan publicly, he's a pig and whatever. Privately, he's a Catholic son. You know what I mean? That's where we could begin here, Brian. But it depends on what medium he's working in. So
Catholic sun or Catholic moon?
Pagan moon, Catholic S-U-N.
Uh-huh.
The light, you know. Jesus.
The bright white light of stupidity.
No, the bright white light of Christ hanging out. He's a healthy, exercising, yoga-doing guy, Jesus. He hangs out in the day and helps people. He doesn't go to the taverns at night. He's been known to hang out at the tavern, but mainly he's a daylight guy, right? He's there happy. He's like you, all happy and bubbly, and he goes to bed early, you know. Not a night person like me. I'm the moon around here, Brian. The evil
right.
Moon. Moon
yeah.
Unit.
The uncanny moon, right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, okay, so we're trying to lay the background of, so Mark Stallman, okay. He comes on. I just find out about this new site, the Marshall McLuhan site, which is for academics, because Willie Benign signed me up, and I didn't know it, and all of a sudden I'm there a couple weeks ago, around middle of May. Well, this is, yeah, in the middle of May, and there's Mark saying the old crap again, the same old bullshit. And so I went after him, and he hasn't been answering me. He hasn't come back that much, you know what I mean? He just shows up rarely, but he takes a couple of pot shots. He put down the MEA for not acknowledging something that Andrew. Now, what Andrew McLuhan, the grandson, does is he wakes up every morning, it seems, and puts out a McLuhan quote, often pretty good stuff. Right, Brian?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you have to comment on it if you want to, but you can't start a thread. I can't start a thread there. Right, Brian?
You on the that Marshall McLuhan thing?
Yeah. You can only respond to Andrew's... there's no place to...
I mean, all those comments were on a post. I made a new post about Burroughs. I think maybe you've just been, blocked out by a moderator.
Have I been blocked out?
Okay. You can still comment on everything, but I think they don't trust you with new posts.
Yeah, when you join, like, they vet you to be a member of it. They have to screen you and decide whether you're allowed in. And so they're probably aware of me. If you can start, like, you know, you go to other places, there's a site. It's an opening. It says comment. Make a comment, you know, and then you start something. But I don't get that when I'm on there.
Mm.
And you do, eh? Just make a comment.
I do.
Well, you better watch it. They're watching you, man, because very quickly, Carolyn, they got mad at me. And then Brian and Roxy came in and were supporting me, and that didn't look good. And Alex Christus got edgy. But then I gave them all a present. I announced to Andrew the 100 hours of McLuhan and Tony Schwartz, which he was not aware of. And he goes, holy shit, this is amazing, Bob, this archive. So they say, well, it's like what Peter Montgomery used to say. Let's keep Bob around because he finds all this incredible stuff, and we can he'll do the research, but we will not acknowledge him. I'm just a gopher. And but I spent yesterday. Did you see all the posts I made yesterday? Brian?
You commented on lots of stuff.
Yeah, and I'm going back. And what's good about this Facebook, if you comment on something, it bounces up to the top again. I don't usually
do
that.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, usually it doesn't.
I like doing that sometimes with old posts.
Yes, yeah, going back and adding what I would have said if I was there 2 months, 6 months ago. So, so we're waiting for Mark to show up. So maybe we should... read something, or do we go right to... See, you ask a good question. I'm saying...
Okay, so, yeah.
We set this up. I posted this thing about, apparently there was this, whatever, about the Burroughs thing. It doesn't matter. And I mentioned that led to me saying Burroughs never liked that line of McLuhan's about turning the body into an environment that includes the universe. Did he ever say anything nice about him? It was the one thing in the letter. And you wrote the story about